Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Foolilove. I'm the Executive Director of the Institute, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you all here this evening for the launch of our inaugural Lowy Institute Media Award. Can I particularly welcome a number of my board directors, Michael Thorley, Jim Spiegelman, Angus Houston, and Mark Ryan, who I have to give special mention to because the whole idea of a media award was Mark's idea. Can I also recognise or mention members of the judging panel and our keynote speaker? I won't name them right now, but I will introduce them soon. But thank you, everybody, for coming from the media, you know, media providers, media consumers all. Our mission at the Institute is to deepen discussion of international policy. And we do this through research, through events, through commentary. And in all these activities, we work closely with the media. We consume the media. We get much of our information and our intelligence from the media, although we have other sources as well. Not as many sources as Nick Warner, but we have other sources. So we consume the media. We contribute to the media with our own opinion pieces and commentary and so on. We use the media to publicise our research and our events, and I might say the media uses us a little bit from time to time too when they need some comment. So we are, every day we work with the media. And this is a traumatic time for the media. I don't think it's controversial to say that. Margins are being squeezed, bureaus are being shuttered, journalists are being made redundant, even op-ed contributors are not being paid, which is, you know, one of the worst offences of all. And to add to that, media consumers like me are faithless lovers. I read The Herald and The Fin and The Oz, but I also read The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal and The Washington Post. And if a Fairfax columnist is not getting the story, then I'll look elsewhere. And if an ABC correspondent is just reading out a local newspaper story during an interview, as I have seen, then I'll switch him off and I'll switch someone else on. And the point is this, I think. If that happens, if people like me go elsewhere and don't continue to consume Australian media, then that's bad. And not just bad for Australian journalists, but bad for Australia. Because we have a view here at the Institute that it is vital for our national interest. I know journalists don't like being dragooned into supporting the national interest, but we think it is vital to our national interest to have Australian journalists reporting, analysing and commenting on events in the world. We think it is vital that we don't all get our news from the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal. There is a particular sensibility that Australian reporters bring to their work. Not every country engages with the world on the same terms, and this applies to journalists as much as it does to officials. Not every story is equally important to every country. A story that in Indonesia that might be very important to us may not be as important to the editors of the New York Times. And so just in this same way that it is important to have, for Australia to have a voice in world affairs, which was the whole reason that Frank Lowy established the Lowy Institute, we believe it is important to have Australian eyes and ears upon the world. Now, up here we have a slideshow with some images of past Australian war correspondents, and let me express my thank you to the Australian War Memorial for lending us these images. These gentlemen, of course, were Australian eyes and ears on Australia's wars. And it was partly to recognise that tradition and to encourage that kind of contribution that we decided to establish this media award. We want to see Australian journalists who work on international issues recognised for their effort, and we want to recognise their excellence when they achieve excellence. Because to me, it is all about excellence. The way to keep eyeballs on Australian stories and Australian screens is to make it excellent. And we thought we could play a role in encouraging that kind of excellence in this, our 10th anniversary year. So that's my ad for the Institute and my ad for the award. Let me tell you how tonight will proceed. When I sit down, we'll serve the main meal, and after that, we'll have a keynote address from our special guest, the head of ASIS, Nick Warner. You may think it's strange that the head of Australia's Secret Intelligence Service would give the keynote address at a media award, but I'm going to explain the method to our madness when I introduce Nick. After Nick speaks, dessert and tea and coffee will be served, and then after his address, I'll step up and announce the inaugural winner of the Lowy Institute Media Award, and then we'll have dessert and tea and coffee. I believe the ABC is recording the event. Is that still right, Steph? So the ABC is recording the event and Nick's address, which is on the record, and of course anybody is welcome to tweet. So ladies and gentlemen, let me finish there. Let me say welcome, very warm welcome to you all. Please enjoy the evening. We've got a wonderful meal. So enjoy the meal, and I'll be back soon to introduce Nick Warner. Thank you. It's my great pleasure now to introduce our keynote speaker for this evening, Nick Warner. Nick is the Director General of the Australian Secret Intelligence Service, a position he's held since 2009. Prior to that, Nick served as Secretary of Defence. He also had a distinguished career in foreign affairs and intelligence, for which he was made an Officer of the Order of Australia in 2011. He was, among many other positions, he was Special Coordinator of the Regional Assistance Mission to the Solomon Islands in Honiara, which is how I got to know him in the mid-noughties. He also has the honour of being the person who's delivered the single most downloaded lecture ever given to the Lowy Institute in our history. Congratulations, Nick. Because everybody wanted to hear from the Chief Spook. I promised I'd explain the method to the madness. Why in a night recognising excellence in the media and transparency and open information, why would we have our Chief Intelligence Officer, our M, if you like, our N, I suppose, in your case, Nick, why would we have Nick speak? And there are a couple of reasons. First, I'm advised that Nick was a baby journalist for about 10 seconds early on in his career, and he might even touch on that in his remarks. But more importantly, it's because Nick is speaking as Nick Warner rather than as DG of ASIS. He's speaking not in his official capacity, but he's delivering an address in honour of his father. Nick's father, Dennis, was a distinguished journalist and war correspondent reporting for nearly six decades around the globe. He was considered by his peers as the war correspondent's war correspondent. He brought the events of Asia to life through his reports from the field, through in-depth articles, books and so on. He brought all that insight to Australians and to the world. And when we decided that each year that we make this award, we wanted the keynote address to recognise an Australian foreign correspondent or war correspondent, we thought that it was absolutely right to get one of Dennis's children to present the first address. Just before I introduce Nick, I might also take the opportunity to mention that another great Australian journalist and indeed novelist, Christopher Kosh, sadly passed away earlier this week. Christopher worked for ABC Radio for over a decade, including a posting in Indonesia. His best-selling 1978 novel, The Year of Living Dangerously, about a foreign correspondent covering the Sukarno affair, opened Australians' eyes to our nearest northern neighbour and won him the first of his two Miles Franklin Awards. So I think there's an enormous tradition, really, of a great Australian tradition here of interpreting the world through Australian eyes. And whether it's the Christopher Koshes or the Dennis Warners, it's something we want to encourage. So ladies and gentlemen, it's wonderful for us that Nick is able to join us this evening to deliver the keynote address this evening. Nick Warner.
Michael, thank you very much. Now, this is actually my third speech at Lowy. I wasn't aware that I'd been such a hit with the second one, but it's nice to be back. And of those three speeches, for obvious reasons, this is the one that means the most to me. Because it is a real special privilege to be able to be here tonight, talk about the career of my father as a foreign correspondent and as a war correspondent. And I certainly warmly welcome the initiative by the Lowy Institute to establish a media award and to pay tribute to foreign correspondents like my father. It's no less important now to have Australian journalists reporting on global events and contributing to the national debate about international affairs than it was when my father began working as a journalist in the 1940s. As you'll all appreciate, I deeply loved, admired, and respected my father, as children do. But he's also a man through his taking incredible risks year after year to tell stories of life and conflict in our region. That helped, I believe, to shape the country we are today, and especially how we see ourselves. Untaking risks, the telegram from my father to my mother, sent from almost anywhere in the world, whether it was from Kashmir or Kabul or Hanoi or Saigon or Seoul or Rangoon or Tokyo, Jakarta or New Delhi. Untaking risks is what the telegram always said. She was at home in Singapore bringing up three little kids and had no good reason to believe him. My father spent 6 decades reporting the conflicts of Asia and Asia's rise. My mother called her first book, published almost 60 years ago, "Don't Type in Bed," and complained that she shared her married life with a portable Hermes typewriter. Flat, battered machine Dad had won from an American journalist in a craps game in Saipan towards the end of World War II. He took it with him everywhere, tucked under his arm, Mum only losing patience with him when he popped it up on his knee in bed to type a story. He wrote well, and he wrote in great volume. Endless articles in the London Daily Telegraph, newspapers in Australia and in the US, Japan, Canada, and New Zealand. He also wrote long, deeply researched stories for a whole range of international magazines. And from 1981 until 1995, he edited the Asia-Pacific Defence Reporter. Somehow, he also found time to write 16 books, some with my mother, and on anything from his experiences in the army in World War II, the rise of China in the 1950s, and why the US lost in Vietnam, to a book on the Russo-Japanese War, and another based on Hiroshige's woodblock prints on the Tokaido Trail in Japan. And then there was radio and TV, including Meet the Press and ABC News commentary. Born in 1917 to apple and hop farmers in the Derwent Valley in Tasmania, Dad joined the Melbourne Herald in the late 1930s. In 1941, having seen firsthand the evil potential of Hitler's Germany in Berlin 5 years earlier, he joined the army. Having described his build as substantial, on his enlistment form and weighing 15 stone and with bright red hair, in April, Private Warner, with only rudimentary training, Angus, sailed for the Middle East with the 9th Division. He eventually made it to Lance Corporal, but only for a day. Surprisingly, during those 2 years in the Middle East, Dad wrote columns for the Herald and the News in Adelaide. Initially, with the permission, and later without the permission of his officers, but always to their fury. To avoid the worst of strict censorship, he sent these stories as long private letters to a friend at the News, who would then chop off the "Dear George" and run the rest in the newspaper. In 1943, Keith Murdoch wrote to the Department of the Army and asked for Dad's release from the Army. The Herald needed someone, Murdoch said, a to replace a journalist who'd just been killed as operational war correspondent in the South Pacific. Dad spent the next 2 years accredited to American forces as they moved through the Pacific towards Japan. Saipan, in June 1944, was his first major operation as a war correspondent. He went in as part of the fourth wave of the US forces. And here's how he described that situation some years later. The executive officer in the Marine Battalion and I stood in the belly of the amphibious tractor with our heads above the armour plating and waited for the signal go. Shit. Look at the mortars and artillery, his companion yelled. Ahead of us hung a curtain of foam as Japanese shells threw up giant water spouts in our path. We made it to the shore, though others did not, and into a battle for which I was totally unprepared. A few months after the Saipan landing, Dad was one of very few correspondents who flew on the mass super fortress raids from Saipan targeting Tokyo, his first sighting of the Asian mainland. Sitting on a stack of field packs and flying boots, he wrote most of his story on the long journey back to Saipan. And this is how he described it, scribbling in his notebook. We bombed the city of Tokyo and now are fighting a bitter battle to get back to Saipan. The tail gunner is unconscious with a wound to the head. We have lost altitude, our gasoline tanks are more than dangerously low. It hardly seems worthwhile writing this story. If we have to make a night landing in the sea, there is not much chance for any of us. Night is closing in and we have hundreds of miles to go. An hour ago, it looked as though we might make it. Now there seems so little chance that I'm giving up writing this story. One can't write when one's as tired and as scared as I am. To Dad's surprise, they made it back, and his story, uncensored, ran on the front page of the Daily Mail. After the war, Keith Murdoch said to Dad, "I think you should go back immediately to Asia and spend the next 6 months travelling wherever you can, right through the areas where the Japanese have been, go to China, go to Korea, go anywhere you feel disposed." Dad did travel widely, writing long stories about the new Asia that was emerging from the destruction of the war. And an Asia that was so different to that of today, poor and undeveloped, and much of it still, of course, under colonial rule. In 1947, he became the Reuter AAP bureau chief in Tokyo, travelling through the ruins of Japan, covering the situation in Korea, where the commander of American forces told him that anyone who didn't think there was going to be a bloodbath was crazy, and getting to know General MacArthur, who told him that four events had changed the world: the birth of Christ, the Magna Carta, the American Civil War, and my occupation of Japan. Our family moved to Singapore in mid-1949. A few weeks after I was born, a year later, a cable arrived from the Telegraph. Cabled you £1,000, proceed immediately Korea. He arrived a week after North Korean tanks had broken through the South's defences on the 38th parallel. The dangers were immense and never ending, he wrote. He was with US forces when they were first attacked south of Seoul in July 1950. He fell asleep one night in the intelligence room of the Cavalry Division Advance Headquarters, asking his colleagues to wake me if there's trouble. At daylight, he awoke, but the building was empty. The whole headquarters had fled. He was actually lucky to survive Korea. Of the 30 or 40 journalists who covered the early stages of the war, 17 were killed. Only days after Dad returned to Singapore from Korea in 1951, another cable arrived from the Telegraph. India, Pakistan, on brink of war, proceed immediately Karachi or Delhi. That was his life, always on the move from crisis to crisis. My father is best remembered for his writing on the war in Vietnam, which he first visited in 1949. He was a regular visitor for the next 26 years, spending many months there every year. He knew everyone, the Vietnamese presidents and ministers, the French, American, Vietnamese and Australian generals, the ambassadors and, yes, the spooks. In late 1952, Dad cabled a long leader page article to the Telegraph. "The position is grave," he wrote. "It is clear the French no longer have any real hope of defeating Ho Chi Minh and the communist forces. Neither the French people nor their government will tolerate forever such losses as are now being suffered in a war which holds out no promise of victory." In 1954, he flew into Dien Bien Phu a few days before the battle began. He was appalled by the vulnerability of the French positions. And later in that year, he was in Hanoi as the Viet Minh took the city. In 1965, Dad was one of several journalists who exposed how the US Army in Saigon was inflating the body count of Viet Cong dead. In the Sydney Morning Herald, he wrote about singly unfortunate emphasis on the kill ratio, the yardstick by which trends are so universally measured. Both the kills and the counts themselves are highly suspect. What no one will accept indefinitely, and especially in a war of this sort, is the persistent attempts to win by pretense what has not been won on the ground. He left Saigon 4 days before it fell in April 1975 with his friends Ambassador Geoffrey Price and Michael Richardson and embassy staff and UN officials with a basket of cats, infuriated that embassy locally engaged staff and other friends had been left behind, although, as he wrote later, there was space for many of them. He had seen his last shot fired in anger, and his days as a war correspondent were over. While Dad exposed much about how badly the war in Vietnam was prosecuted, he saw the strategic value in it. He believed the war bought time for the non-communist countries of Southeast Asia to strengthen themselves and to concentrate on reform and economic development so that they stood firm rather than crumbling. While Vietnam had drawn Dad back year after year, he was also covering the rest of Asia. Based in Singapore from 1949, he got to know Lee Kuan Yew as he started his long political career. At a party in 1954, Lee said to a group of journalists, including my father, "In 7 years, the communists will have this place." Dad asked, "What will your role be, Harry?" And he looked at Dad coldly and said, "I'll be a party functionary responsible for refusing visas to correspondents like you." They became good friends. In 1957, Dad was in Iran, Afghanistan and India, where he interviewed Nehru. In 1960, he was in Cambodia, interviewing Prince Sihanouk. In an article entitled "Prince on a Tightrope," he wrote, "As long as Sihanouk is able to continue the astonishing balancing act he has chosen to perform, Cambodia may survive. But as he would be the first to admit, it's a tricky business and there is no safety net below." And of course, there wasn't. And years later, Sihanouk and Cambodia fell into year zero. In the mid-1960s, Dad spent a lot of time in Indonesia covering the failed coup and the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of Chinese and the elimination of the Indonesia Communist Party and later the fall of Sukarno. In 1978, he travelled up and down the coast of Malaysia, writing about the boat waves of refugees. And in 1980, he was in Gwangju at the time of the massacre in South Korea. Most of my family are or were journalists. My father, my mother, a sister for a while, and a son who is annoying the AFL in Melbourne. I opted out, as Michael said, with one brief and unsuccessful exception. And here I have to apologise to my colleague, my former colleague, Angus Houston, who I've never told this story to. I didn't think it was wise when we were both running defence. It was in 1970, the height of America's involvement in Vietnam. I was 20 and had been conscripted but had a student deferral. All things being equal, I would be deployed to Vietnam in the next year or two. Unlike the reaction of a lot of parents at the time, I expect, to their son's call-up, Dad saw my conscription as a great opportunity. An opportunity for us to film a documentary together in Vietnam. So, long-haired and scruffy, I was detained at the airport in Saigon when we arrived in mid-December. The authorities had been expecting a group of Australian anti-war protesters and thought that I pretty much fitted the bill. Dad's plan was that I would interview a few key Vietnamese officials and Australian military personnel and then, believe this or not, go on patrol with the Australians. It had all been agreed and arranged before we got to Saigon. Gary Cunningham, who was killed in Balibo in 1975, was our cameraman. Young, naive, and nervous, I made a hash of the interviews. And somehow, probably because of the way I looked, and actually some of the comments I made to the Australian commander, meant that we got the Australian military offside. So when we got to the Australian base at Nui Dat, the gate was locked to us. We weren't welcome, and the interviews and the patrol were cancelled. In order to try and save the documentary, you would all understand this better than me, we interviewed diggers, we drove down to Vung Tau on the coast. And there, having been escorted to a nearby base, we were told that we'd been detained. Dad was furious. He rang Canberra, trying to get in touch with Malcolm Fraser, who was then Defence Minister, and Andrew Peacock, who was Army Minister. After many calls and many arguments and a long wait, we were finally allowed to go. That was the end of my journalistic career. But with this incident and others in mind, in a speech almost 20 years later on the changing role of war correspondents and in a message, Angus, to the ADF, Dad had this to say. If you know what's good for you, you'll embrace a small core of responsible correspondents and clutch them to your unwilling breast. Stop placing ridiculous barriers in the way of them doing their job. Treat him, the journalist, as a friend in whom you have confidence, and you may just be surprised. Harass him, and you'll suffer for years. The last story Dad wrote as a foreign correspondent was in late 1999. He and I travelled to Torokina, a small and remote village on the west coast of Bougainville. On the blackboard of a dilapidated schoolhouse, Dad found a poem written in English and Pidgin, which in part read, "Let peace be found here, let love abide, may our hearts be filled with happiness." That became the centrepiece of his article in The Australian, reflecting not only his hopes for Bougainville in 1999, but also for the island which had been ravaged during World War II. He knew well what the island had been through because he had visited Torokina before. In 1944, 60,000 Japanese and about the same number of Australian American forces were locked in bloody conflict on Bougainville. The night he arrived in Torokina, the Japanese attacked the perimeter of the US base, launching waves of suicide attacks, with some succeeding in getting through the American lines. In his story for the Herald, he wrote that the Japanese infantry that at Nanking had committed atrocities unheard of since the days of Attila, children raped and bayoneted to death, had now sacked their last town. Hundreds, he wrote, lay dead along the Torokina wire. What Dad didn't write at the time, couldn't write at the time because it wouldn't have got through the censors, was the behaviour of the US commander. The morning after the attack on the perimeter, Dad went out with the commanding general and was appalled as wounded prisoners were executed. My father was a man of principle. He joined the army in 1941 because he understood the threat of Nazi Germany. He stood for election in the federal state of Franklin in 1943 because he believed the country and the government weren't doing enough to help the soldiers fighting overseas. He confronted South Vietnam's President Diem with photos he had taken of prisoners being tortured, because he deplored cruelty and barbarism. He was at the forefront of the fight against the White Australia policy because he abhorred racism. He railed against communism and against any form of repressive government, whether it came from the left or the right. He was opposed to the invasion of Iraq. He thought the way the current war was being fought in Afghanistan was foolhardy, just like the wars he covered in Indochina. Along the way, over those 60 years of researching and reporting, by fighting hard for what he believed and writing fearlessly, he made many close friends and also some important enemies. He received death threats through the mail. Wilfred Burchard sued for libel and lost. He was at various times banned by the French from returning to Indochina and later by Xi'an. He was blacklisted by Sihanouk. And with other Western correspondents, he was placed on an assassination list in Saigon. Some of this worried him, some he regretted, some he resented, and most he shrugged off. It was the price he felt for writing what he thought was right. And running through all of this, through his career as a journalist, indeed through his whole life, was Asia. My parents fell in love with Asia, its people, its culture, and its history. They lived in Japan and Singapore, travelled widely for work there as tourists, and wrote about Asia's problems, politics, conflicts, and hopes. As Michael Richardson has put it, they helped to break down the barriers that divided Australia and Asia, and were amongst the first Australians to understand Asia, its strategic significance, and its importance to Australia. Much as my father's early writing, both for newspapers and in books, was aimed at educating Australians about Asia. As he once wrote in the 1940s, Australian ignorance of Asia was almost bottomless. Australians needed to learn, to adapt, to change, and to understand Asia and Australia's place in the region. Through his books, newspaper and magazine articles, and his radio and TV appearances, my father played an important role in making Australia the country it is today. Cosmopolitan, multi-ethnic, more tolerant, fairer, better informed, more secure, and with a much greater understanding of Asia and its importance to our future. As my mother, in time, heartily agreed, the risks were worth taking. Thank you very much.
Well, Nick, that was a wonderful speech. Thank you very much. I thought it was wonderful to hear about a great man like your father, with a person of humanity and breadth and principle, a character of the size that doesn't seem to exist anymore, or perhaps doesn't seem to get to the highest levels of politics or public life these days. I'm really struck by it. What a life. I mean, it makes the life of a foreign policy wonk in Sydney seem pretty dull. I'm glad to see he always had an eye for the story, even if it involved conscripting his son. I'm also glad to hear that, and I can recommend to young people who come in to see us, that if you fail in your journalism career, you have a future as a storied spy master. I was a bit surprised. I thought when he was relating MacArthur's four great world-changing events after the birth of Christ, I thought the fourth one was going to be the birth of MacArthur, but it was actually his occupation. But look, I thought it was wonderful. I think it's a wonderful. I think it's a nice thing to be able to speak about a fallen parent, but it's a difficult thing. So thank you very much, Nick, for giving such a wonderful speech, and curse you for making it so difficult for us to find an equally deserving speaker next year. So, ladies and gentlemen, please thank Nick Warner. fuller version of the speech without some of the redactments that we suggested. We thought we'd get back at the spooks by redacting it a bit. A complete version of Nick's speech is available on the website now, so please have a look at it. Ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the part of the evening where we announce the winner of the inaugural Lowy Institute Media Award. The winner will receive a return, some return travel to Asia and a cash prize of $5,000, as well as a beautiful trophy, which is not right there. Is the trophy somewhere, Steph? Ah, there. Thank you, Kate. That'll be the check. This is a beautiful trophy, and let me say a special thank you to Dinosaur Designs, represented tonight by Helena Trahanis. Where are you, Helena? Thank you very much, Helena. Dinosaur Designs have kindly donated this beautiful and unique trophy. It was designed by Louise Olson, and the idea was very much in the spirit of the award to evoke the idea of an eye on the world. Obviously, Dinosaur Designs, like the Lowy Institute, in fact, is an Australian-born company that has global ambitions. So thank you very much to Dinosaur Designs for helping us with this trophy. Ladies and gentlemen, we brought together a distinguished panel to judge the award. Former Australian Foreign Minister Alexander Downer, journalists Max Uttridge and Jana Vent, Lowy Institute Board Director Mark Ryan, and myself. And can I thank Max, Jana and Mark for being here. And can I particularly thank them and personally thank them for the spirit that they brought to the judging lunch that we had about a month ago. It was well oiled with some good wine to help us reach a consensus, but everybody came to it with a wonderful spirit. Can I also mention Chris Masters, who's here this evening, who was a very valuable source of counsel and advice early in the process. Thank you, Chris. I know a lot of awards, other awards like the Walkleys, have a formal nomination process and it becomes a bit of an industry, I think. We took a different approach and we asked the judges, who are themselves all keen observers of reporting on international affairs, to bring their nominations of the best writing and stories that had appeared over the last financial year to the judging lunch. And in addition to that, the Institute research staff got together and also suggested a list of nominations for consideration. The criteria that we put to our distinguished judges were four. First of all, topicality, the importance of the issue or issues to Australia's engagement with the world. Secondly, influence, the degree to which the journalists' work informed or shaped public discussion of international policy. Thirdly, originality, the extent to which the work brought attention to a new international issue or idea or re-examined an existing issue from a new perspective. And finally, quality, the standard of the writing or the broadcast. This year, the judges settled on four wonderful finalists. First of all, Trevor Borman for his foreign correspondent reports on Prisoner X. Secondly, Rowan Callick of The Australian for his coverage of developments in Fiji and PNG, which raised the profile of issues affecting those countries and of Australia's relationships in the Pacific. Thirdly, Jo Chandler for her compelling coverage of witch burnings and the tuberculosis crisis in PNG. And finally, John Garnaut of Fairfax for his long series of high-quality articles explaining the Chinese leadership transition, as well as breaking news of an incident in the South China Sea. I was delighted that, fueled by all that expensive wine, the judges reached a consensus decision, so we didn't have to negotiate with Alexander the different voting methodologies. And the winner, we felt, the work of the winner helped to illuminate a country that is extraordinarily important to Australia and the world. And I'm delighted to announce that the winner of the inaugural Lowy Institute Media Award is John Garnaut. As one of my fellow judges noted in nominating John, his reporting is high quality, it has high impact, and it's beautifully written. I might say, from my personal point of view, and only speaking on behalf of myself, John's work has two things to recommend it that really synced with our ambitions for the Institute. First, he was an outstanding Australian foreign correspondent in China. He reported not only from the capital in front of Tiananmen, but he reported from the provinces and from the field. We didn't consider this story for the award because it didn't occur in this financial year, but many people here will know that in a previous year, John broke the Stern Who story and won a Walkley for that. But also in his work in this financial year, I certainly felt that he had contributed to my understanding of developments in China. But secondly, and just as importantly to me, he made himself an essential and sought-after global commentator with expertise on the Chinese military and China's elite family politics. His analysis of the downfall of Bo Xilai and of China's leadership transition has been outstanding. And I know that John is currently completing, or perhaps that's a bit ambitious, currently writing the manuscript for his full-length book, The Princelings, which will be published in Australia and abroad at the end of next year. And that, again, to us was important, not just to be an outstanding Australian foreign correspondent, important though that is, but to have the ambition and the ability to tell that story to a global audience. So congratulations, John Garnaut. John, obviously we didn't reveal to you in advance, so we haven't asked you to prepare anything, but would you mind saying a few words? John Garnaut. Actually, let me hand over the check. We should have had a big 10-foot wide one, and let me give you the beautiful...
Thank you, Michael. It's an enormous privilege. In fact, my whole job was an enormous privilege. And it's also a very humbling experience to stand up here after your speech, Nick. I think I lived, if I'm not mistaken, in the same compound as your sister. And I had no idea that you came from such an extraordinary background. I'll never be able to share the experience of being a war correspondent because it's written into my marital contract that I shall never go anywhere near any war zone. And I've more or less kept that. But so there's probably, at least from the Chinese point of view, probably more crossover with your profession, Nick. I was in, it reminds me, listening to your speech, I was in... It was a very, very complicated procedure, but I got into to Tibet last year, and in fact it was so complicated that I found that I couldn't actually write anything. But when I was there, the guy who was showing me around, and I'd sort of suspected what his profession was by his military police number plates, and he said to me, "Look, so, you know, you say you're a journalist, but what do you really do?" And I said, I'm a journalist. "Yeah, but, like, what do you do?" And I said, "Well, I go out and get stories and I try to make relationships with people and analyse it and explain it." He goes, "Exactly, you're a spy." And I said, "I'm absolutely not a spy." And he said, "Look, from our point of view, it's exactly the same category. We teach you exactly the same. So it doesn't matter what you say to us, you're a spy." that was one of you know, an endless stream of just wonderfully exhilarating experiences that I was able to have in China. I remember Connie turning up to my first job interview, actually, at Fairfax down the road, and there was for Fairfax to be a trainee, and Tom Burton was there, and Kate Bice, and Mark Coulton, and Mark just looked at me and said, "Look, I bet you just want to be a foreign correspondent like every other bloody trainee." And I said, "Yeah, I do." And, you know, and I can't remember what her name was, but there was the Glossy magazine person, and she says, "Well, how long do you think, you know, how long do you expect to be a foreign correspondent?" And I said, "Well, Tom's just been telling me it's a merit-based organisation, so if that's true, then 5 years." And they thought that was a bit cheeky, but I said, "Look, if it doesn't work, then I'll just go and do something else. That's fine." So anyway, they got me up to Sydney, and 4 years later, our competitors suggested I go down the road, and so I was in Tom Burton's office again. And Tom said, "Look, what we'd like to do is take you and Tara, choose your destination, go check out Tokyo, Beijing, Jakarta. And so within about 5.5 years, we found myself in Beijing. And it is by far the... it is the highlight of my career. I can't actually think of anything more exciting or fulfilling to do. You know, people ask, how is it, what's it like being home? Well, so far it's just very peaceful and nice and pleasant, but I'm sure I'm going to have to find something else to kind of say to that before too long. But it is a privilege, and I think one of the reasons it's a privilege is that particularly in places where people in Australia don't necessarily have a very nuanced feel of how, like, you know, as Dennis was talking about so often, and China's a little bit different because there was enormous hunger. You know, I sensed right away that, well, I was very indulgent. You know, I wrote what I wanted to write, and I buried myself in all sorts of arcane things, and my foreign competitors or peers would just say, you know, how do you get away with writing that stuff? And I think, I think in Australia they're kind of interested. And it was true. You know, my editors would just go, well, carry on, and I'd keep filing these pieces on the sort of arcane intricacies of Chinese Communist Party politics. And I think Australia, more than possibly any other country except perhaps, you know, a few neighbours of China's, Japan and Singapore, was actually really interested in working China out. And so from my point of view, I was being paid to do exactly what I wanted to do. It was the most exciting job on earth, and as far as I can tell, people in Australia were interested to keep reading. So I thank you, Michael and the Lowy Institute, for supporting that project. Fairfax, a whole series of terrific editors who, you know, Fairfax doesn't get a lot of credit around the place, and it is struggling in many ways, but I've had nothing but very consistent, extraordinarily consistent support from them. Essentially, carry on, tell us what's going on, and, you know, and do as you please and as you can. So I appreciate that. I've had fine counsel from people like Peter, from Ross Kittens, and several other luminaries around the joint. I'll never be a war correspondent, but so far I reckon I can't imagine anything else that I'd prefer to do than what I've just had the privilege to do. So thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for the formal proceedings. Thank you, John. Congratulations again. Thank you all for joining us at this inaugural Lowy Institute media event. We think it's a success, so we're going to do it again next year. Thank you to Nick for a really wonderful keynote address. Maybe everyone can give Nick another hand. Why not? And thank you, everybody, especially members of the working media. We know you have a lot of other things to do, and we look forward to many citations of the Lowy Institute in the near future. Thank you very much, and enjoy the dessert.